Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
There we go.
Here's John Williams.
Happy day after Mother's Day. Hope you had a nice weekend and a nice day. This is John Williams. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. We're here weekdays till 3. That's 1 to 3, Monday through Friday. And that's Friday. Then we do a show on Saturdays as well. That's from 10 a.m. until 12 noon. On all social media, you can find me and this show at WGN King John on Instagram, on Twitter, and on Facebook. And speaking of social media of sorts, congratulations to the Mincing Rascals team. I mentioned this on Saturday. Perhaps you weren't listening just then, so I'll just mention it one more time here. I'm not a big one for awards and talking about them, but the Mincing Rascals podcast that we record at the studios at WGN Radio on Thursdays was submitted for an award in Chicago, and it won Best Podcast in the City of Chicago.
Wow.
It was at the Lissagor Awards. Peter Lissagor was the Washington Bureau Chief for the Chicago Daily News from 1959 to 1976. He was one of America's most revered journalists at the time. You may not remember him from, say, the 1960s and early 70s, but he was the Bureau Chief for the Chicago Daily News. You'd see him on Meet the Press. You'd see him on Face the Nation. And they established an award, the Chicago Headliners Club, to reward the best in journalism. And the Mincing Rascals podcast was the recipient of that at a ceremony Friday night. Whoop, 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 whoop.
Congratulations.
The Mincing Rascals is produced by Elif Garris. It's engineered by a real good guy named Ben Cortez. And it usually includes Steve Bertrand, me, Eric Zorn from the Chicago Tribune, the columnist and editorial writer Christian McQuarrie, and their editorial cartoonist Scott Stantis. We kick around all sorts of things, state, local. We always go to Trump land. And then there's usually an odd topic. We always close with our recommendations, too. Something we're reading, listening to, watching, eating, drinking that we think you might enjoy. Usually runs about 30 minutes. You should be listening to podcasts, and I hope that you include us when you do. The Mincing Rascals is what you want to type in wherever you search for your finer podcasts. Steve Bertrand, congratulations to you and Elif and everybody. That was nice.
It's a nice award to, if you're going to win an award.
And by the way, the $1,000 that I got for that is really not necessary.
John, that money was to go to the selection committee. You weren't supposed to keep that.
Oh, I was supposed to give it to them.
That was to distribute.
I also saw that Scott won Best Cartoonist for a publication of over 100,000.
Let's not make this all about Scott.
Okay. Yeah, Scott.
Blah, blah, blah.
I believe his sixth Lissagor Award.
You guys deserve a congratulations.
Thank
good
you.
Job.
Thank you, V. And Steve Bertrand's won them before, too. So just push the others out of the way on the mantle, Steve, and you can put the Mincing Rascals up there. We'll talk a little bit about the Kelly Sadler, Meghan McCain, John McCain story in the 2 o'clock hour. We'll just sort of catch up on that. I've got a couple questions about it. We'll talk with a couple of scientists about the mission to Pluto. Yeah, we sent a satellite by there a couple of years ago. And the guys that were in charge of that literally were at the Adler Planetarium on Friday. We caught up with them, and I'm going to let you hear part of a conversation we had. And we'll also in the, when are we doing that? At 2 o'clock, talk to Carla Narowski, who is the what is her title? CEO of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library Foundation. Have you been down to the Abraham Lincoln Museum in Springfield?
Yeah, it's so cool.
Isn't it, though? I mean, you think, Springfield's a sleepy little town, and Lincoln was the place we went to go with the field trips when we were in eighth grade. This museum is spectacular.
I did blend in with eighth graders, though, because there are a lot of them there.
And a lot of them are taller than you.
Yeah. I'm like, I'm not with this class. I'm here by myself.
I drove, for instance, and I'll be at the bar afterwards. Exactly. So that's how you know.
No, but it's really cool. And the hologram thing, I still can't, I don't know what was real and what wasn't, and it bothers me.
They have the actual dress, the actual hat, the actual clothes, what they say and how they display the loss of life in the Civil War. Will just put tears in your eyes. It's interactive. There's a movie that you can see. It's really just really well done. And I, you know, Springfield, you might go to a Cardinal game in St. Louis, or you might go to the Quad Cities and gamble, or Peoria. I don't know what your travels in the state are, but I would put Springfield on the map just for this museum. Carla's going to come by a little after 2 o'clock and talk about the funding problems they're having. And so, lo and behold, they've got a Marilyn Monroe dress. They've got a Marilyn Monroe fur. Really? And then some stuff that if anybody should have, the museum in Springfield should have. And they're contemplating selling it off. Talk about that in a little while. Speaking of raising money, Chris Christie and the folks in New Jersey, once upon a time, said we ought to be able to bet on sports. Chris Christie is no longer the governor of New Jersey, but the current governor is cheering this Supreme Court decision on, too, which says that this is a states' rights issue. The federal government should not be able to ban states from enacting laws that would enable you to bet on baseball, basketball, hockey, football. Think about that. All the major leagues and the NCAA pleaded with the Supreme Court to don't change your rule on this. We don't want organized gambling. After the Supreme Court said the states can enact laws that enable them to gamble, some of the leagues are like, well, we'll see what happens, because maybe they have a lot of money to make. I'm not sure what the fallout is or how that reflects on the leagues.
It is weird that there was a federal law that said you can do it in Nevada and nowhere else.
Think about that. Or, I mean, it's all kind of weird anyway. States have gambling. It's called the lottery. And you can apply for a license if you're a church to have bingo. That's gambling. So, you know, we're always trying to manage the damage on this. I think the only reason that we should not have gambling, two come to mind. One is the integrity of the games. But that's up to the leagues and the players to manage. The other one is people who might easily be addicted and fall prey. And that's always going to be problematic, but it's something that we've decided to do as it is, right? We let you smoke. We let you drink. Heck, we're going to enable you to have recreational marijuana. So we cross that bridge all the time. I don't know how this is that much different if we're worried that people would be addicted to these things. It's going to be more difficult for them to live their lives. But, oh boy, the state's going to make some money. It would just be very weird to me, though, to say, okay, you can bet on a horse in the Kentucky Derby and you can go play the slots. I get that. I got my head around that. But that I could bet on I could have bet on Game 3 of the Cubs-White Sox. You could bet on Game 3 of the Cubs-White Sox.
Well, that's Pete Rose stuff.
I know, and, you know, I guess the law would have to indicate, or the leagues themselves would have to say, okay, it's legal to bet on the Cubs and the White Sox in Illinois, but the players and managers, anybody with a paycheck from those organizations can't, right?
So, but that, people are still betting, are they not?
Yeah, absolutely they are.
So
absolutely
make some money on it,
are.
Then.
Listen, I was talking to Sam Panayanovich, who now works in Nevada, right? And he may join us on this tomorrow, but he said that in Europe, you can bet on the games at the venues. You could go to Wrigley Field, walk right up and go, before the first pitch is thrown, here's 100 on the game today. Which is
just like their horses.
I know. And, you know, would you worry that that would impact the outcome of the game? That if there's a lot of money and the the Cubs whooped the White Sox the first time and they beat them the second time, there's no way that the White Sox are going to beat the Cubs right now. So the margin is 4 runs. And everybody's betting then that the Sox are going to win, the Cubs are going to win. Would you worry that a lot of money on one outcome or another would impact the outcome of the game? Would you worry that a lot of money on a game would impact its outcome? If everybody's stepping up is going, you know what? I like this guy pitching for the Sox, though. And we close the gap in game 2. Let's put our money. Here's $1,000 on the White Sox.
Right. Would you have believed the Cubs won the World Series in overtime, in a rain delay? And I mean, all those things, right?
Right. So you say, aha, well, that was weird how that happened. I wonder how, why that happened. I wonder how that worked out.
And no, actually, it's not overtime. It's extra innings. I knew that.
I just slipped out. Yeah, that's all right. These things happen.
Sports stuff.
My question for you is, don't be the legislator. You can be if you want. You know, should Illinois pass a law that enables us to bet on the Cubs and the White Sox and the Bears and so forth? Another question is, should we enable you to bet on DePaul and Northwestern and Loyola? Holy cow. Could you have bet on Loyola and made some money? You would have had to, you know, people did. They went to Las Vegas and did it. But wouldn't it have been fun if there were kiosks at the school?
Can you bet on college sports in Vegas?
Yeah. Yeah, you can. You can bet on your brackets. You can bet on your brackets. I don't know. I think you can bet on every single dang game. Okay. Would you want to do that? Right? I mean, wouldn't it just be kind of fun to click, click, click? Hey, Cubs and Sox. Holy cow. This starting pitcher for the White Sox, he can never get out of the first inning. The Cubs are hot. What the hell? I'll throw 50 on that. It's a good bet.
Well, plus then you're invested. There's so many other things that go along with betting on a team.
Right. Now it's more fun. I mean, that's why you love the NCAA tournament. It's because you've got a bracket. By the way, Steve, my estimated probability of accuracy on yes, you can bet on the NCAA tournament legally is 59%.
Oh, that's pretty low for you.
That is low. That is low. But I'm never above 70.
But you still say it so surely.
I'm a talk show host. So my question for you, 312-981-7200 is, advise me and the legislators, would you like to be able to bet on the Cubs and the Sox and the Bears and the Blackhawks? Would you like to be able to bet on the Bulls? Of course not. They suck. But, I mean, would you like the opportunity to be able to bet on these teams? Would that be fun? Would it scare you that you'd start to throw too much money into it? Wouldn't scare me. But I it would be fun, like Violetta said. Now, Cubs are playing. Who are they playing? The Sox are playing. All right, the Twins, that's kind of interesting. But if I've got $25 on that game.
Yeah, but then guys never let you talk. They're like, I got a lot of money on this. Quiet. I'm like, oh. Okay.
Well, there's that. There's a social implication. Okay, 312-981-7200. Call me or text me right now. You want to play on these teams? I'm interested in your input. I know the legislature is, too. John, what happened to the federal government law rules over state government? I'm not sure what that question means, but the Supreme Court said that this is a state's issue. And Yahoo.finance.com today said that as many as 30 states, it's estimated, in the next 5 years will probably enact laws enabling their citizens to bet on sports. We'll pick up a couple of phone lines. We go to Nick. You're on WGN. What do you want to say, Nick? I think it's Nick. Nick is gone. Let's go to, is that Irv? Irv, you're on WGN. What's up?
I'm all for sports betting since we already have, you know, racetracks and casinos. As long as we have it at a racetrack or a casino where it is already, like, fully secure. I just heard that in New Jersey, Mammoth Park, one of their racetracks is in full flex. They're ready to start in about 3 weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
So, as long as we have it at a place that already takes gambling, I don't want it, you know, propping up on every street corner. But I'm in favor of the sports gambling, and hopefully a part of that would go toward helping the racetrack industry, because that's where I work, and we're really fledgling. So if we can all work together and, you know, support one business with another business, I see no problem with betting on any sports whatsoever.
Steve Bertrand and I had a disagreement today in the halls. Imagine that. And it was over whether or not this helps or hurts Arlington Park. I love Arlington Park. I think it's just a great thing for Chicago.
I do too. I'm prejudiced. I work there. So,
well, but let me finish my question for you. But here's the deal. But I don't bet on horses, and I don't know a thing about them. And I'm not interested in horses because I didn't ride horses. I'm not a horse, stuff like that. But I am interested in betting on baseball, football, basketball. I would put money on a Butler game, I think. Maybe I wouldn't. Lord, I shouldn't. But I wouldn't on horses. So Steve says maybe this will help Arlington because now you could go to Arlington and you could bet on the Cubs game or the White Sox game. But I'm thinking you probably could at an OTB. Maybe if they crafted the law, you could at Wrigley or at the Cell. You could do it on the South Side, a guaranteed rate. So now you don't have to go to the track to bet on the baseball games. You could at other locations. And if really what the track represents to you is not a love of horses, but a love of gambling, I think this ends up hurting Arlington, right? Because Now, anybody that wants to do any kind of gaming, shoot, you don't have to bet on horses. You can bet on anything. You don't have to go to the track at all. You don't even have to pay attention to the horses because you know the Cubs and Sox and Bears and Bulls and Blackhawks. You do understand that. I think this hurts the horse racing industry. What do we know? Well, we'll find out. Thanks for the phone call. Irv, I appreciate you joining us. I'm going to go from you to Logan. You're on WGN. Hi, Logan. What do you say?
I'm totally against it. Actually, I've been betting online through a sports book for the last 18 years, and that's already addictive. I know people, if they have an opportunity where they only have to drive 5 or 10 minutes away to place a bet on the Bears, the Cubs, Bulls, or whomever, that it's going to be a problem. It's going to be just where families are going to fall apart. It's just that easy to get addicted to sports gambling.
Do you consider yourself addicted to sports gambling?
I've been down that road. I've been addicted. I've been homeless. I've lost everything. I've lived in Vegas. I've lived out of my vehicle. It started off with casinos, and it went into sports gambling because it was just more convenient. Found an online SBG Global, actually, I got money on the Cubs right now in the first five innings that Atlanta will actually either be tied or up by the end of the fifth inning. They call it first five. You know, I got 105 to win 100 on that game right now. So I'm going to say the addiction is still there. It's not as bad as it once was. But if I have access or I can just go 5 or 10 minutes away and make this bet instead of winning online and paying to have the money sent to me or waiting 5 to 7 days to get it, then I will definitely be betting locally instead of online. So it's a bad thing. I think people will be hurt because it'll open up the doors to people who've never done this before, and it will catch you just like any other addiction.
So you've got $100 on the first five innings of today's Cubs game.
Yeah, it was minus 105, so it was 105 to win 100. I just need Atlanta to be tied or winning by the end of the fifth inning to be able to collect.
You know, and I kind of, when I was discussing this a minute ago, I said it'll be hard for some people, but the state will make a lot of money. And then I rubbed my hands together and kind of laughed dismissively, maybe in your case. But you are the sort of person who is really going to suffer or struggle more as a result of something like this.
Absolutely. And I wouldn't be the only one. I mean, I've had issues in the past. And, I mean, right now I'm banned from Western Union and also MoneyGram.
Oh, no.
Because I used to send money to my sports book through there, and it's illegal.
Oh,
and after investigating and tying me to them and the way they do business outside of the country, I can never send or receive anything, either of those two, because I deal with an online illegal sports book, you know, as far as what we do here in this country. So, I mean, there's definitely negatives to gambling, period, but just to give us that much access is not a good thing, especially for guys like me.
Good luck to you, Logan. I really appreciate you telling us that. That's very helpful to the discussion. I appreciate your call.
I appreciate you letting me speak. Thank you.
Yes, I'm John Williams. Here's another fascinating bit of sort of science. And this comes from a book I read called Chasing New Horizons, written by Alan Stern, who was the leader of the New Horizons project to Pluto, where we sent a satellite there a couple of summers ago, and David Grinspoon, who is an astrobiologist and author. They visited with us on Friday last week. We had White Sox baseball, so we recorded a conversation. Let me set a little of it up this way. First, you have to appreciate, as they tell you in the book, how fantastic the mission was. I'm just slayed by the science of it, all right? Think about it this way. If you took Earth and you shrunk it down to the size of a basketball, Pluto would then be about the size of a pea, 220 miles away. I mean, everything is so reduced that Earth is the size of a basketball. Pluto is so far away, it is still past Springfield. You could go see Abraham Lincoln's hat, and you still wouldn't be to Pluto yet. 9.5 years before it actually encountered Pluto, they sent this tiny little satellite, think the size of a molecule, off from that basketball. And it travels for almost a decade. Halfway through, almost running into Pluto. But then, no, not running into Pluto, just going on the outskirts of Pluto so that its gravitational pull pulls it in and then zings it faster out into space. And that zinging takes it right at Pluto. And then you travel for like 10 years to Pluto, and you don't run into Pluto, and you don't go too far away from Pluto. You have to just go right by Pluto. And then at the exact right instant, you say, okay, take some pictures, take some pictures, take some. God, man, take pictures. And all of that has to go well. I asked him to put it into some perspective for us, and they at least said this.
Perspective.
Go.
This morning, we flew in from Detroit. New Horizons, after 9.5 years and 3 billion miles, was more on time than that 1 hour.
Yeah, really. And, you know, my luck, my luggage is on Saturn, too. So then I got to wait. Yeah. I've got to
conversation.
The conversation started with a little joke, right? But then we started to talk about how that mission came to be. And I thought it was well put when Alan Stern said, this was America at its best. The funding of it, the politics of it, the science of it, and then the actual accomplishing of it. And then, as they reminded us, the problem solving of it 2 weeks before it was going to encounter Pluto.
Man, this was one of the really scary moments. Everything had been working so well. And as you say, you know, it had traveled more than 9 years, was closing in on its goal, million miles a day, barreling in towards Pluto, 10 days before it gets there. Only a week before it was going to begin the, you know, its really most important observations, what we call the core observations, the spacecraft disappears in that from Earth. It ceased communicating. All of a sudden, they lost contact with it. It was 4th of July. So as Alan says, you know, if they got some fireworks, but not the kind they were planning. And so, you know, most people were gone at barbecues, and they have taken their kind of like final chill out a couple of days before the intensity of the flyby. And all of a sudden they had to activate the phone tree. Alan gets a call from his project manager that, you know, something's not right. And he said, you know, we have lost contact with the spacecraft. And then, you know, people start showing up in flip-flops and bathing suits from their 4th of July picnics. And then it's like Apollo 13, you know, they're in crisis mode and they're sleeping under desks and they're all there all night and eating out of candy machines and just pressed into action. And for a brief time, it seemed as though the spacecraft could genuinely be completely lost. Very, very frightening. And then, fortunately, they regained contact with it, but it's messed up. It's not in a state that it can execute the flyby. And they have to, in a hurry, a real hurry, because they're approaching Pluto. They're going to fly by whether they're ready or not, whether it's working or not. They have to reload all this software that had been lost that previously had taken months to load. And they have to do it in a real hurry, and they have to get it exactly right. If any line of code was wrong, the whole mission could have been lost. And this team, it's so heroic. At this point, they're so far, the spacecraft so far from Earth, it takes 9 hours to get a signal there and back. And there's not much time. And so it takes 9 hours to say to the spacecraft, hey, are you there? And it goes, yeah, what should I do next? That's 9 hours. And then, you know, and then there's, you know, switch to a faster communication rate. And then, you know, that's another 9 hours. And then they start testing and loading up these commands. And they had to do it. So much work, months of work in just like 72 hours, basically, and got it exactly right.
Because the satellite isn't going to orbit Pluto. It's going to fly by Pluto.
Right.
Just I mean, you'd have a margin. You'd have room for error if you were going to fly around and say, well, we'll figure this out while we're orbiting.
No, it's one shot.
You're going by.
It's going through
33,000 miles an hour or whatever it is.
Yeah. And by the way, this is not just the story of Alan Stern, although he's obviously central. There are a lot of heroes in this book, and one of them is this woman, Alice Bowman, who you'll read about in Chasing New Horizons. But she is the mission operations manager, or what they call Mom. And
for those who saw Apollo 13 and remember the Ed Harris character?
Yeah, sure.
That ran Mission Control, right, with the flat top and the little vest and all that. That's Alice's job for Pluto New Horizons. Mm-hmm. All the folks that work there work for her, and she is the orchestra conductor. And she had to pull this together, and it was brilliant.
In this moment, Alice and her team shone. You know, all the training paid off, and they, you know, with hours to spare, her team rescued the spacecraft and got it back on track so that it could execute the flyby of Pluto.
You know, when they make the movie, then suddenly the images will come up bright on the screen. They'll go, we fixed it. The signals are there. And then all of a sudden on the big monitors, we'll see perfect images of Pluto, but that's not the way it happens, is it?
No.
So you've got it fixed with hours to spare. But then, talk about a exercise in patience. So then what happens?
There were many, but one way that, additional way that we haven't talked about, that we saved money to get in this small budget box was by de-scoping the capabilities of the communication system to much lower data rates than Voyager had had back in the 70s. But that saved over $100 million because it let us get away with one, not two, nuclear power supplies. And that meant, in turn, that after the flyby, where we had taken literally 100 times as much data as Voyager and put it in flash drive memories like you would have on a thumb drive, it would take 15 months to send it all back, day after day, week after week. Total delayed gratification.
Was there, though, a moment when you did get either the first image or the best image or a surprising image? Take me there and tell me.
Actually, there were lots of moments like that. And in a way, for the science team and a little bit for the public, because the data kept raining down week after week, 70-something weeks worth, it was as if we were still at Pluto. You know, the presence, if you take the analogy, the presence just kept landing and we kept unwrapping them.
There was something called the fail-safe data set. Because there was a genuine concern that something could happen to the spacecraft at the moment of closest approach because it was flying through the Pluto system. We didn't know what hazards were there. They did a really good job to try to assess the hazards, but there was some risk. So there was the last package of data that was sent down with a pretty darn good full disk image of Pluto. Not nearly as good as they got after the flyby, but there was that moment when that fail-safe image came down and you could really see Pluto as a world, you know, with a big heart, the big white heart, which is this big nitrogen glacier and all these other features. And, you know, that was the moment it had gone from a dot to a world. So when that picture was revealed, you know, the moment of the flyby, that was definitely one of those moments where, you know, in the movie, it's on screen and you go,
wow.
And then, of course, there was the very dramatic moment of the phone home when they found out it had worked. And that was an emotional catharsis with the team hugging and screaming and all the cheering crowds. You know, it was a moment of triumph. And then the next day, the really detailed pictures started to come down. And that was definitely another. There were several of those moments of, you know, everybody's there in the auditorium and the picture comes up on the screen and people are just blown away.
Hubble wasn't able to get these sort of images? Were we seeing things for the first time?
Oh, not at all. Hubble, which got the best images of Pluto ever, could only resolve a smudgy little disk. It's hard to imagine. This is why we do planetary exploration, is we need to get up close to see things in detail. If you had an image of the Earth at the resolution of Hubble's best image of Pluto, it's a blue ball. You can't even resolve that there are continents. You can't tell Asia and the Americas are there at that resolution. I've actually had pictures of the Earth pixelated to the same degree as the Hubble images of Pluto, and you can't tell what the hell's going on. So then we send a spacecraft there, and now it is literally a million times closer.
What surprised you?
Nearly everything, but at the top of the list, the complexity that Pluto showed rivaled big planets like the Earth and Mars. The fact that we saw very strong evidence for an ocean inside, beneath the crust. Wow.
Liquid?
Liquid water.
Really?
Liquid water.
There's liquid water, you think, right now under the surface of Pluto?
Yeah, and there's solid water on the surface. It makes all the mountains.
And it's liquid underneath because it's a warmer thermal cavity underneath.
Yeah. And then we also saw on a vast scale that Pluto is geologically alive today with flowing glaciers that are overturning at the same time, and avalanches are recharging the glacier.
It looked like you saw dunes, too.
We did see dune fields.
Great areas, you know?
Yeah, and we saw volcanoes the size of Mauna Loa, but they put out ice, not
isn't
you know,
that
not
amazing?
Lava.
Well, if there's enough heat and water, is there any chance that it might be incubating life in some
form? We just have an astrobiologist to my left.
You know, you think of the requirements for life as we currently understand them. You need water. You need organic molecules, and you need energy. Well, there's definitely a lot of organic matter in the Pluto system. It's raining down from the skies, staining the surface red in places. And they're clearly their energy sources because of all that geological activity Alan was describing. So he checks all the boxes. So I would say that post the New Horizons encounter, Pluto now has to be added to that list of places in the solar system where there could be life.
I guess to what end is a fair question then. I mean, it's not intelligent life, and we're not going to be able to... I guess we don't, huh? There could be something swimming under the surface that's existing and communicating and wondering, huh? I mean...
Who knows?
I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if I had to guess, it would be more likely to find microbial life. But we're very ignorant about life in the universe.
Very ignorant about life down here. That's David Grinspoon, who's an astrobiologist and author, and also Alan Stern, the guy who was in charge of the New Horizons mission. The book is called Chasing New Horizons. They were at the Adler Planetarium on Friday. Lucky you if you saw them there. It's 1:52 on WGN.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
In fact,
here's John Williams.
We think of some over the weekend, too. It's 2:08. This is John. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue for a little longer.
Lord have mercy.
Then we'll move across the river later this summer. We're here until 3 weekdays, Saturdays, 10 a.m. till noon on social media. We are... WGN King John on Instagram, on Facebook, on Twitter. Congratulations to the team at WGN Radio that does our Mincing Rascals podcast, the winners of a Lissagor Award for Excellence in Journalism over the weekend. And that includes Steve Bertrand and Elif Garris, our friends from the Tribune, and yours truly, our friends from the Tribune, Scott Stannis, Kristen McQuarrie, and Eric Zorn. And our studio right now is Carla Nowrowski. She is the CEO of that Abraham Lincoln Presidential Libraries Foundation down in Springfield that we've been talking about. So welcome to the show. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
This world-class museum is in Springfield. You live and work out of Chicago, though, huh?
Yes, I do. When you serve Lincoln's Library, you could virtually live anywhere in the world.
So what happened? The library bought a collection of items that included Lincoln stuff, right?
Yes. Back in 2007, we bought a collection of 1,500 items. Our collections were very heavy on documents, but this was a collection very heavy on his personal artifacts.
So it was you bought a collection of 1,500 items.
Yes.
But not every single one of them was a Lincoln item per se, right?
Pretty much all, but... Seven.
Seven items. Is that that's where the Marilyn Monroe dress falls in?
Correct.
What were the other six?
They're all related to Marilyn. There's the dress. There's a bust of Carl Sandburg that she owned, and he was one of the foremost biographers of Abraham Lincoln. And then there are seven photos of her meeting Carl Sandburg for the first time. And it turns out that she, you know, even though she's known as being a sex symbol, she was actually a very intelligent woman with an intellectual curiosity, and her favorite president was Lincoln, and she was a voracious reader about him.
So she's a Lincoln file. So
yes.
The person that was collecting this stuff, the collection which you bought, included a Marilyn Monroe dress.
Correct.
Not the one that she wore when she sang Happy Birthday to the President.
No.
It's not an iconic dress that I would recognize from a movie per se, but it's a Marilyn Monroe worn dress.
Absolutely.
Which is so weird. Okay, so in order to maybe help save this collection of Lincoln stuff, a Marilyn Monroe dress has to be sold.
Unfortunately, yes.
Do you display that dress in the museum in Springfield?
Not every day, but it was recently displayed in an exhibition of some of the more quirky things that we have in our collection that you wouldn't expect to be there.
I see prices around $70,000 it might go for.
I can't really say. I've been told by auction houses that it could range, it can run the gamut from $70,000. It can go for six figures. We don't really know.
Huh. Okay. So you've got to pay, though, for the loan that was used to purchase these items?
Correct.
Well, was it a bad decision to borrow money to buy these items if, in fact, you don't have the money to buy these items?
That's up for different people's opinions. We don't believe so. It really enhanced our collection. Since we purchased those, about 4 million people have visited the museum and library and seen these items. Prior to our purchase, they were in private hands, and you never would have been able to see them. Scholars never would have been able to use them for scholarly research. We've loaned them out around the world. And so we thought it was, and we still think it is an incredible collection. We were good to purchase it. The difficulty was that we were only a few years old at the time of the purchase, and so we did not have the money. And if we did not purchase them right then,
you'd lost them.
We'd lose them. And it's not like going out and buying a soft drink that you can get anywhere. This was the only place to get these.
Okay, so it's maybe ironic, maybe sad that in order to get the items, you have to sell some of the items, but you still will retain many, many of the items, however much you have to sell.
That's our hope.
The question then becomes, what do you sell?
That's a difficult question to answer, because if we went through the list, naturally we wouldn't want to sell any of them, but if we had to part with some, we might identify some lesser items of lesser importance, and yet those aren't
money.
The ones that won't sell, so
right.
We may be forced to sell something very iconic.
You give me a handwritten Gettysburg address, you might be able to solve your problem in a fell swoop.
Exactly.
Will you sell his Gettysburg address?
No, we won't. That's part of the permanent collection that came before we purchased this collection.
So you're only selling items that are part of that previous, this collection we're talking about that you acquired?
Exactly.
You could sell anything you want, though, right?
Yes, we could.
But you've determined that you'll only sell things from that collection that you bought.
Oh, no. We will only sell from the collection. We are not allowed to sell state items that are in the state collection
already.
Well,
this is a thing, too. Why doesn't, how much money do you need now?
$9.7 million.
And the loan was 24?
The loan was 23. It's a $25 million collection. $2 million of it was gifted to us.
What's the interest on that?
It varies, but it's been substantial.
So the longer you hold it like a mortgage, the more you're going to amass.
Correct. Which is one of the reasons why when the note is due in 20 short months, we don't want to refinance.
You don't want it's a variable rate loan.
Well, yes. Well, interest rates are rising, and so invariably we are going to pay a higher interest rate than what we're paying now.
All right, but this is crazy. I know Illinois's got problems, but Lord, we've got $9 million. Are you kidding me? What does the governor say about this?
Well, the governor's office has been working with us to try to find a solution. So has the legislature. We've also been working with community leaders, private citizens who've been donating money all this time. We think that $9.7 million is not a lot in the scheme of things, statewide, federally, for what the man did.
You've paid $15 million of it off, but now you're short $9. The clock's ticking.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so what items are you contemplating selling in June?
Well, it's difficult to say what we're contemplating, but I'll tell you items that could be sold, such as...
What's the difference between the two, contemplating and could be?
Contemplating makes it sound like it's on the top of our list, I guess, for me. I guess it just makes me a little more nervous, but they could all be sold. Any of the items in
the
collection.
What are you considering? What are you considering selling?
What could possibly be sold are the bloody gloves. These are the gloves that he had in his breast pocket the night he was assassinated, and they have the blood from that evening. We could possibly sell...
I'm sorry, stop right there.
Okay.
May I?
Yes.
What do you think that'll go for? What a morbid question, but here we are trying to raise money with Lincoln's bloody glove. What is that? Does that get you $1,000, $1 million? How much do you get for that?
No, that could bring us 7 figures. That could bring us 6 to 7 figures alone.
6 to 7 figures. You might be able to retire the note on his bloody gloves.
Quite possibly, as auctions go. But we don't want to.
That's ghastly.
It is ghastly.
And are those on display there right now?
They are on display from time to time from a preservation standpoint. We can't keep them out round the clock, but we bring them in and out, different items in and out based on time of year, different exhibits.
But talk about that. Maybe it's not such a tragedy. What would somebody do that bought them?
They would put them in their private collection.
At a privately run museum?
No, not necessarily. If a privately run museum or a public museum decided to bid on them, then that would, you know, obviously they could stay in the public realm. But invariably, it's a private collector who will put them in a vault in their home. And unless you know them and they invite you to their house, you're not going to see them.
I'm sorry, who does that?
Private collectors. There are some out there.
Hey, Bob, what do you want? So I go over to Bob's house.
Yes.
Really? Like that, huh?
Yes, exactly.
I guess would it assuage some of your anxiety about this, or some of mine, if it was in a museum? If another museum bought it, then while it wouldn't be where it should be in Springfield, it would be in the public realm. Would that make you happy?
That would make me happier as somebody who yeah. believes that Lincoln belongs to the people, but it would not make me happy that it leaves our museum in Illinois.
what
the land
besides
of Lincoln.
The bloody gloves, then, are you contemplating?
His presidential seal that he undoubtedly pressed when he was signing the the 13th Amendment, or the Emancipation Proclamation, I'm sorry. His quill pen that was on the desk, left on the desk the night he was assassinated.
The pen he was using to write documents, letters, who knows what famous things.
Yes, because even though he had other types of pens, he was still partial to a quill pen, and so we have that quill pen. China from the presidential White House, notes that he, personal notes he wrote to Mary regarding their children, such as shoe Tad's horse or get some plank board and plank for Tad to do things in the White House. The button that was cut off by a doctor who happened to be in Ford's Theater the night of the assassination, and it's the button that came off of Abraham Lincoln's suit. The fan that Mary was using that evening.
We have a couple of items from Mary that night: the fan and the handkerchief.
We have a handkerchief of his.
Yeah.
We have a piece of her dress from that evening.
So, would you say the highest value on these Lincoln items are associated with the assassination?
Not necessarily. We also have an item that is the oldest item linked to Abraham Lincoln in known to be in existence today, and that's from when he was 14 years old. It's called a sum book, as in S-U-M, or cipherbook page, and on it, he does his long division. And in the corner, like any 14-year-old boy, he writes, "Abraham Lincoln is my name, and with this pen I write the same. I wrote it here in haste and speed and left it here for fools to read." So it obviously shows that Abraham Lincoln, at a very young age, that he had his sense of humor, that he had a wit. That, of course, is priceless. We have his Bass Ackwards joke, because he wanted to tell a story, and he didn't want to actually say ass backwards, so he said Bass Ackwards, and he actually told the entire story reversing the letters. It really is.
And that's written now?
Yes, and it's a unique document.
Question, I guess they didn't have typewriters. Did they have typewriters then? No, they had a printing press, but they didn't have typewriters, did they?
You know,
I don't think so. It's handwritten, is my question.
Yes, and we would have. It's an excellent example of, again, his sense of humor.
This is also personal. It's just sad to think that the handkerchief or the fan or the button or, Lord, the gloves or personal note to his wife about their son would be sold off. It seems so mercenary, and yet we're all in this business, I guess.
Yes, I mean, We purchased it for a reason, and we're trying to save it for a reason. We want the public to be able to see it. We want the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library Museum, his presidential library, to be the place where you can come and see it. It's down the street from the only home he's ever lived in and owned.
Where did I see the other day? I think I saw that the average Illinoisan, if every man, woman, and child owned up to the debt the state has, I think it would be $10,000 a person. The last thing any of us needs to do is layer more on. But if you want to calculate what my share of the 9 million is, what do we got about? I think we have 12 million people in Illinois. You need 9 million bucks. So it'd be less than a buck a person. I'm okay if the legislature would say, everybody, we need a dollar.
That would be wonderful. And it's true. You know, we say that all the time. And when we think, well, 4 million visitors came to visit his library in Springfield just since we've opened. But his, you know, he is legendary, not just in Illinois, not just in the United States, but the world. You know, when people around the world celebrate his greatness, our detractors hold him up to us as if a mirror and say, hey, are you living up to all he espouses? It's very important. And I'll give you one other fact. I mean, we're obviously focusing on this 9.7 because that's crucial.
Do that in just a minute. It's 2:20 on WGN. And in our studio, Carla Narowski is the CEO of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library Foundation. Have you been following this story? Isn't it strange? They have a Marilyn Monroe dress and all of these very particular and personal items about Abraham Lincoln, due to be auctioned off, potentially, to pay off the note that they used to actually acquire them and many other items. I'm in for a buck. I mean, hello, Rauner. Hello, by the state legislator. My number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. You can call or text if you have a comment, an observation. Should the state write the check? The state could write a check, right?
Absolutely,
I think the state should. The state should write a check. Look, Illinois is a lot of lousy things these days. If anything, we are the land of Lincoln. We should preserve this. Okay, you get a chance to talk next. 312-981-7200. Steve's got headlines for us in about 9 minutes. The First Lady has just undergone kidney surgery. That and more news coming up on WGN. Carla Nowrowski's in our studio. She's the CEO of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library Foundation. They're in Springfield. Have you been following this story? They're talking about selling precious Lincoln-related artifacts in order to pay the loan they used to acquire some of them. And some of the most interesting or precious ones might be peeled off to pay a note that you've been working on for how long?
11 years.
Before we broke, you wanted to say...
That in addition to this loan, which paying off the 9.7, which is vital, we also, unlike most presidential libraries that have endowments that are $30 million to $500 million...
What's your endowment?
$2 million. And we find that, you know, I know that we're a fledgling institution and that we're only about a little over a decade old, but $2 million for the Great Emancipator just seems to be too small.
So if you raise more money than you need, you just put it to the foundation.
Yes.
How much money does the state give you now?
State gives us about $11 million, or gives, I should say, to the museum and library, $11 million annually for its operating budget. So they're very generous. We don't want to make it seem as though the state is not coming to the fore, but with regard to the collection, that's a capital expenditure that we're still hoping to get something for.
And you're going to be going backwards if you don't retire the note. I mean, you have to sell these items. You've got to retire the note.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, you're just going to eat into your foundation core, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Pick up a couple of phone lines here. We'll start with, let's see here, John on line one. You're on WGN. Hi, John.
Hello, John. Your suggestion that the state of Illinois pay this $9.7 million debt, wouldn't that check bounce?
Yeah, that'd be ironic, wouldn't it? Very funny. But yeah, I mean, well, that's the double edge. That's the double whammy here. You know, it'd be nice if the state of Illinois would pay the bill, but the state of Illinois can't pay its own bills as it is. But bills are getting paid. I mean, it's not like we don't generate any revenue here. We're talking about $9 million. Does that frustrate you? And do you think that the state will somehow bail you out before you have to auction these items off? Or do you think you're going to have to auction them off before the state comes riding in on a white horse?
No, I have faith in the state. You know, there have been some legislators from both parties who've come forward that say we have to do something, we can't let this happen, and I have faith that they're going to come through.
John, why don't they start a GoFundMe page for the Lincoln Museum?
Interestingly, I think it just popped up today. I can't say if it's active today, but if it's not active today, you will see it tomorrow.
This texter says, add $10 to everyone in Illinois' income tax to save Illinois' memorabilia. It's the right thing to do. Is there a checkoff box on my state income tax form?
Interestingly enough, we had asked for that in the past, and that never was able to happen. But I there are those opportunities, and we would love for that to happen.
King John, I can't tell you how much it breaks my heart to hear that any of Abraham Lincoln's personal possessions would be sold off.
It breaks my heart, too. It breaks our board's heart, the staff's heart, those who have generously already given to the tune of $15 million. People have worked very hard to ensure that these things stay in the land of Lincoln and are there for the public the world over. And we're doing everything we can to ensure that they stay.
In a state that has billionaires and multimillionaires running for governor, this texter says, John, tell JB I'll give him my vote if he pays off the loan. Ha, ha, ha. But really, he could write a check. Boy, wouldn't that be nice? I would vote for the guy if he'd do that. But he hasn't called you either, huh?
Well, actually, he has been supportive of our institution over time.
Oh, he's been a private donor?
Yes, he has.
Yeah.
He's recognized in the group of donors as a supporter of our institution.
What can we do for you? I got to let you go. What do you want to say?
First of all, thank you for this opportunity. We really want the word to spread. If your listeners could help make this go viral, people can make a donation at www.alplm.org for Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library Museum.org. And any amount is welcomed. There's no small gift. A gift too small or obviously too large to help us do this.
This is a crime, and Lincoln's death was a crime. Let's Not Compound It, ALPLM.org. I'm going to put a link to that on my Facebook page. Maybe you're already there. I'm WGN King John on Facebook. We'll include a podcast link to this conversation and all of the information you've been talking about. Carla, good luck. Hopefully the auction will be staved off. If not, is it in June? It's in Las Vegas.
The auction in June is for only the Maryland items.
I see. So you have written those off. Those are going to go.
Those are committed to go.
But let's not put these other great items out for bid as well.
Absolutely.
Okay, good luck. Stay in touch.
Thank you so much. We will.
Carla Nowrowski is the CEO of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library. Thanks again to our guest. After the show today, by 3:30, on my Facebook page, I'm WGN King John. By 3:30, we'll have a link to not only the interview that we just did, if you want to share that with somebody else who wants to hear this story about Abraham Lincoln and how they may have to sell off some of that stuff. It's ridiculous. It's sad. It's terrible. We'll have a link to the interview. We'll have a link to the GoFundMe page that they've established. Only in Illinois would we not be able to pay lottery winners and have to have a GoFundMe page for our own state artifacts. And we'll also have a link to their foundation website, ALPLM.org. It'll all be on my Facebook page. I'm WGN King John. By the way, a couple of texts about that. John, Rauner and Pritzker each have over $50 million in their campaign funds. Why don't they help the Lincoln Museum? Again, she told us that when JB's name came up, he has been a donor. John, excellent interview. And from 630, John, how about $5 million from JB, $5 million from Rauner, bipartisan support for the state? They need nine. That would be 10 and the problem would go away. Like that. The problem would go away like that if those billionaires would each write a $5 million check. I know it's easy for me to spend somebody else's money, but I'll bet if I had billions of dollars, I would do this.
So what happens if you're J.B. Pritzker and you are listening to your show?
Grandstand, every day? And you grandstand?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Is it grandstanding or?
Totally grandstanding. And it, but it totally works, too.
Okay.
So ask the current president if being transparent about your motives can still work, can still pay dividends. I think that would, sorry, Donald Trump doesn't belong in this conversation. We'll get to the Trump administration in a second. But Steve, so what's the solution if you're JB or Bruce Rauner to not help them out?
No, because I'm just saying, does he get, if JB Pritzker comes through with $9 million,
yeah.
Then does that help him or hurt him politically?
All right, let's go around the table. Violetta, JB just gave $9 million to save the precious artifacts from the Lincoln Museum in Springfield. Does that make you more or less likely to vote for him? Go.
I think it's a nice thing to do, but it could be criticized.
I didn't ask you that. We know that. I'm saying,
isn't that funny? You can save the museum, you dirty dog.
I know, but I bet, really, no good deed goes unpunished. But I won't because maybe people write the check. Hell, write the check anonymously. And then let the Tribune figure it out.
Oh, there's no, that's not happening for sure.
What do you think, Steve? Answer your own question.
I think it'd be an interesting exercise.
In?
Well, I mean, he probably would take a little.
He would take some heat for it. Because you know what they're going to say?
What it does
he's
is
trying to buy votes.
Well, but it also just points out just how rich these two guys are. But, you know, maybe we already know that.
Have you seen pictures of their houses? Hokey smokes.
You mean when you said houses, you mean each of theirs houses?
Yes, theirs houses.
Right, not that each has one house.
No. Yeah.
No, I haven't.
Yeah, well, guess what? They got $5 million extra for the plumbing. Okay, enough about that. All of that stuff to help out or at least be concerned. On my Facebook page, I'm WGN King John at 3:30. Share it with your friends. In the meantime, you've probably heard this.
Sarah, thank you. We've heard a lot about White House aide Kelly Sadler reportedly saying in a meeting that the president shouldn't worry about the senator's opposition to the nomination of Gina Haspel because he is dying anyway. Meghan McCain, his daughter, wondered aloud today why Kelly Sadler still has a job here at the White House. Does she still have a job?
I'm not going to comment on an internal staff meeting.
Following up on that question about Kelly Sadler's comment, does the White House not think that you need to condemn these remarks or comment?
Again, I'm not going to validate a leak one way or the other out of an internal staff meeting.
Are you saying that you didn't say this?
Again, I'm not going to validate a leak out of an internal staff meeting one way or the other. Jonathan.
Does the president regret what he said during the campaign about John McCain when he said he wasn't a war hero? He prefers people that weren't captured.
I believe the president has spoken about that. I haven't talked with him specifically about that.
Why not just apologize to Senator McCain?
Again, I'm not going to get into a back and forth because people want to create issues of leak staff meeting.
Just a quick follow up on one of my colleagues. To be clear, does Kelly Sadler still work at this White House?
Yes, she does.
She does. Okay, and to follow up on that.
Kelly Sadler did, we understand, apologize to Meghan McCain, who on The View said this.
I don't understand what kind of environment you're working in when that would be acceptable, and then you can come to work the next day and still have a job.
President has still not tweeted about it. I have two things to say about this, and I'll let you comment on this if you want to. Number one, I think an apology that is forced out of you is not an apology. I think it's too late.
I apologize.
If they really feel contrite about it, then they should have said something without this sort of national discourse. If, for instance, if you were the McCains and the president said on behalf of the administration, we apologize, does that feel sincere? I think it's too late for an apology, number one.
It's better than nothing.
Number two, I would say this. There's a lot of bad guys in this story, and none of them are named McCain. But I'll tell you somebody who else should have maybe thought twice about what they were doing, and that is the person in the Sanders staff that leaked it. Because even if your intent was to burn Sarah Sanders or burn the president, right? Look how awful these people are. Somebody evidently on Sarah Sanders' staff thought that and decided to leak this information. How did they think that was going to impact the McCains, the guys on his deathbed? Maybe he's not. He's been up and down. But he's planning his funeral, right? So how hurtful is it to the McCains? If you were in that meeting and you heard Kelly Sadler say that, you should have not shared that with anybody. That could have died right in that meeting. But no, you're either stupid or mean or petty, or you've got some grand agenda against the administration, and you decide to, sure, embarrass the administration, if that's capable, but really, you're going to hurt the McCains. And Meghan says, oh, we're better than this. We've got a lot of love out there. I know that, but this is not nice to them. Why would you share that?
John McCain's already planning his funeral. So, I mean, I don't think you're going to... I think he can take something like this.
What a sad way to go for this to be the conversation.
But if anything, you see the opposite of what's been said. It amplifies him as more of a hero to everyone who sees the truth.
Fair enough. It's a great reminder of what a great guy is. Everybody's coming to his defense. But I think we would have remembered that anyway. If you were the person in that room and you heard that joke, what's your obligation?
They hate each other.
You have
There's never been a White House like this one, John, where they turn on each other, they stab each other.
Who's the they in this?
Everyone in the administration.
A lot of the people on the staff.
It's the most leak-prone administration, and a lot of it is done backbiting because they don't like each other. I mean, they did this. I was listening this morning. I think it was Axios or Politico did a story on the leaks and why they leak, and the leakers explained why they leaked.
It's Big Brother to like reality TV in the White House. It's their confessionals, and they're constantly
leaking. It's not
leaking.
Big Brother, Violette. It's just it's.
Oh, she doesn't mean the Orwellian version.
No, I mean the
TV show version.
I know it's the kindergarten version. Sure,
yeah.
Okay. But here, Jana, I really thought you were going to go this way. It's Monday. I can't believe we're still talking about this.
You're mad at us?
I'm not mad at us, but I'm thinking this was said by a low. This was a bad joke said by a low level person.
It should have died in that meeting.
But you say it often. You're like, you know what? If this wasn't Trump, we wouldn't still be doing it, or we get too exercised about things.
I have the
does
this matter meter.
This one doesn't.
It does not.
This was a bad joke.
Fair enough.
And they should have. Sarah Sanders on Friday should have said that was a deplorable thing to say, and she's staying on, but we apologize for it. It might have been over.
But that has not happened.
No, it hasn't. It should have. But even beyond that, it's been 4 days now.
Entertain my question, though, Steve. If you were in that room and you heard that joke, should you have or would you have shared that?
No.
Thank you. That's all I'm saying. And you're right. I understand why it happened, because they've got this sort of Lord of the Flies, Big Brother, the TV show version of everybody hating on everybody, everybody gossiping. Those are the people running our country right now. I wish they wouldn't do this. This is not a story that matters, except that it's there, and it's more evidence of how mean-spirited these people can be.
It was a bad joke. I've made bad jokes before. I've said things that are...
Steve,
I wish I hadn't said.
Sure. All right, so let me ask you this. Should Kelly Sadler still have a job?
Sure. She should have apologized.
She should not have a job, not because she said it, not because she said it, but because it was leaked. That's why she should be fired, because it colors the administration, an administration that won't apologize for it. They should fire her over this.
Well, look, they should have said instantly, this was a terrible thing, that we apologize to the McCains, a great war hero, and all of that.
I know
they
what
Americans...
They should
have done that. They didn't, but it's really, I was shocked. I mean, it's coming up on the Sunday morning shows. It's still coming up today.
Oh, this is not going to go away anytime soon, my friend.
Well,
I know what a lot of Americans are thinking. What does Matt Bubala, my former producer and a late night host here weekends on WGN, think about this? Let's go to line 9. Matt, you're on the air.
Hey, John Williams. You know, I think we have to remember how the whole thing started earlier in the week, though. How did we all find out that Trump was not invited to McCain's funeral? That was put out somehow. And if you think about President Trump and how he feels about things and how he takes umbrage at things, he had to be furious that a news story is how he is not invited to this funeral and how they don't want him there. And so somebody in his administration, I mean, this is the guy that demands loyalty, that asks for it from high-level people, right? So when Kelly Sadler says something like that, he's not going to fire her. That's somebody standing up and throwing a punch for the boss. That's the ultimate show of loyalty, I would think, in his mind. And do we know that it was leaked from somebody else on the communications staff? I mean, we know all these stories about before he was president, how he used to call publicists and pretend to be somebody else.
Well, Matt,
he might have okayed this leak.
Somebody in that's interesting.
He loves that this leaked out.
I know, because a lot of the leaks, right, the questions in the New York Times from the Mueller investigation were probably from the Trump administration. That's probably how that happened. But imagine if it was the administration itself that orchestrated this just to crap on the guy. Matt, if you were in that room, would you have shared that joke with the rest of the world? Would you have leaked it?
I agree with Steve. We have all said terrible things at some point in our life
that we
read or shouldn't have said or have said in a private room. Of course you don't leak that unless, A, you want Kelly Sadler not to keep moving up in the administration and you want to sabotage her, or B, you want to take a swipe back at the McCains. Of course, nobody should have leaked that. She shouldn't have said it. It should have died in the room. You're right about all of that. But it's no accident that it got leaked out.
That's Matt Bubala. When are you going to be on the radio again?
2 a.m. Saturday morning.
You haven't called me in a while.
Once in a while.
No, on the air. Matt will ask me to come on and visit with him on the radio.
I was just on with him last week, and I love it.
All right, buddy. Good to hear your voice. Come by and see us in the studio sometime, Matt.
We'll do. Good to hear you guys.
Have Jack drive you in.
He's a big boy. Yeah, by the way, how's Jack doing? How are the kids doing?
Everybody's good. They're getting old fast.
That car I sold you still working?
Yeah, it's got a lot of problems, John.
Matt, does it really? Is it giving you, was it a lemon that you bought off of me?
Well, you know, it has about 100,000 miles on it, so you expect some issues, but it's been in several times. And
oh,
now it's got
no.
Ugly tires that we got replaced.
Wait a minute, the tires were good on that car, weren't they?
They seem to be, but when we just took it in for an oil change, he said there's an issue with one of these tires. You got to get it replaced.
I'm sorry.
Don't be sorry. It's an old car.
The deal's final.
So
I mean,
we could leak what you paid, John, or you could buy it back.
Goodbye, Matt.
Bye, John.
Bubala. Anna DeVlantis, happy day after Mother's Day.
Oh, thank you very much. Hope you had a good time. Hope the moms were all treated very well, as I was on Mother's Day.
Judy Pilak's kids bought and planted a tree for her.
It was a good day.
What a sweet gift.
That is
right?
So thoughtful.
Our producer, Brian Altimer, he went and planted flowers for his mom.
Oh, nice.
In flower beds. So
nice.
It's a great gift. It really is.
What are y'all kicking around?
Well, if you don't like the storms, if you feel like we've had too many storms, Demetrius Ivory is going to tell us how you might not be thrilled with the forecast. He's got what's coming up and how things might cool off a little bit. We talked with ABC News about the new embassy opening in Jerusalem and the violence that has erupted, that deadly violence, I should say. Also, do you like the betting on sports? Does that happen in your household, or do you like that, John?
I do for the NCAA basketball tournament.
Mm-hmm. The brackets.
And that is so much fun.
I love it.
And the idea that I could bet on the Cubs-Sox game. is kind of intriguing. And I am not a gambler.
I'm not either.
Has no pull to me. And all of a sudden, like,
you get incited, engaged about games you never even would. That's what I find. My nephew is into it, and he gets so excited, and then he gets me excited about games.
So it's tempting, but it's also a little scary that way, too.
It's going to be may become easy, may not. It's up to the states, is what the Supreme Court has decided in this new... the gambling ban, they struck it down. So we're going to talk to Greg Carlin. He's the co-founder of Rush Street Gaming about if it could become in Illinois or what the options would be if that's what you're interested in doing.
I'll be listening.